Tomorrow is the national release for the sequel to Black Panther, Wakanda Forever. Expectations are super high for this superhero film. The 2018's Black Panther was not only extremely financially successful at the box office, it also won a trio of Oscars and was the first movie from the genre to get a Best Picture nomination. In making the sequel, the production team also had to work in the emotional and physical shadow of the late Chadwick Boseman. The actor who played the Black Panther in T'Challa in 2018 died of colon cancer in 2020. And ahead of this new movie's opening, we're going to talk about the historic rise of this particular superhero and where the franchise goes from here after such a difficult loss. And we want to hear from you. Were you a fan of the 2018 Black Panther movie? Are you planning to see Wakanda Forever? And if you've read the graphic novels along the way, what do you have to add to the story? What do you think of the adaptations for the big, big screen? Join us, 800-642-1234, or email us, ideas@WPR.org. Our guest is Brian Carr. He's an associate professor of communication, information science, and women and gender studies at UW Green Bay. He is also the author of the book, The Transmedia Construction of the Black Panther, Long Live the King. And Brian, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a thrill to be here.
And usually we would give you the origin story of a superhero character and where they're coming from, but let's do the real world origin story of the Black Panther. How did this character originate?
So this is a character who originates in issues number 52 and number 53, I believe, of the Fantastic Four series. He is created by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. And this was an attempt by Lee and Kirby to essentially try to tell a different story about Africa. If you look at a lot of how Africa and its people were portrayed in comics at the time, it was very regressive, very stereotyped, and quite frankly, very racist. So the attempt was, well, what if we told a story about an African nation with a king who was not only a great scientist, but a great warrior, but also led a very technologically advanced nation beyond anything even America and the great Reed Richards and the Fantastic Four could come up with. And so that is really kind of the origin of this. And it's worth noting, he sort of predates the real life Black Panther Party by a couple months. Those issues come out, I believe, in the summer of 1966. And then it's a couple months later, we see the Black Panther Party actually start in Oakland, California. So that, as you might imagine, that led to some challenges for Marvel from a branding standpoint for a few years.
So Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, and I think a lot of comic book, every comic book fan would know their names. Here's some middle-aged Jewish guys from New York who created the Black Panther. Were they Afrofuturists? What did they say about their creation?
Well, I would certainly be hard-pressed to say they were themselves Afrofuturists. I don't think they knew what the word for that would be, because, you know, certainly it wasn't something that was on their mind. I think they definitely saw the opportunity. You know, as you mentioned, these are two middle-class Jewish guys from New York, working-class guys, especially Jack Kirby was. He grew up, you know, he was not from wealth. He was a kid who was going out getting the scraps on the street, that kind of thing. But he had a lot of friends from different cultures, different backgrounds. He had white friends, black friends, and so on and so forth. And, you know, he would say in later years, like, I drew Black Panther because I'd never really put any of my black friends. I had black friends and I never put them in my comics. And I thought this was an opportunity to kind of rectify that. And Stan Lee would also, for his part, kind of talk about like how this was an attempt to, you know, they always said the Marvel universe is the universe outside your door. And so there was this kind of push at a lot of the sort of editorial level of Marvel to include and sort of tell stories from these kind of perspectives and viewpoints you weren't necessarily going to get in a lot of other comics and a lot of other media at the time. Now, again, it should always be noted that, you know, when we talk about comics history, there's always a bit of, you know, ambiguity about the truth and sort of where things came, because nobody's writing anything down and a lot of people want to try to make themselves look good. You know, we know basically that, you know, these were not people writing from the black perspective, but they were certainly people who were sympathetic.
Our guest is Brian Carr, associate professor at UW Green Bay and author of the book, The Transmedia Construction of the Black Panther. And you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Now, onto the character itself, T'Challa, the king of Wakanda, who is the Black Panther as a superhero. And one of the things that stands out to me as this superhero is you have Batman who has all this wealth, Iron Man who has all this wealth, and their superheroes seem to come from their infinite amounts to spend. You have Spider-Man who's bitten by a spider. You have the Hulk who's a radioactive accident. But for T'Challa, where do his superhero powers come from?
So this is actually something they don't really elaborate on too much, but eventually they do reveal. And this is something, you know, when we talk about superheroes, these are especially characters who've been around for a long time, like the Black Panther. There's a lot of kind of tweaks and changes as we go. For instance, when they were first creating those original comics, they hadn't really sketched out Wakanda as a place, right? And so they kind of mentioned, oh, he gets his powers from this herb and stuff like that. And he has the stalking suit and these technological abilities and all this gear and gadgets. And Wakanda is, you know, the, you mentioned Batman and Iron Man have a lot of wealth. Well, one of the things that makes Black Panther kind of special is that he too has a lot of wealth. You know, he mentions early on, like, I have wealth beyond like pretty much anything anybody knows, right? My nation is incredibly prosperous because we have essentially cornered the world supply of vibranium. And over the years, vibranium becomes this metal that everybody wants. It's essentially a clear allegory and a stand-in from everything from gold to uranium and the Cold War and that kind of thing. And it's this metal that has these incredible properties that allow it to absorb energy and kinetic energy and redirect it and things like that. And over time, essentially, it becomes magic, like really like it's magic. Anything the writer wants vibranium to be, that's what it is. But, you know, this is important in the larger context of these stories is that, you know, when you look at the historical sort of carving up of Africa by outside nations and Western nations and that kind of thing, a lot of it was this was a resource rich continent, right? Precious minerals, diamonds, all these things. This was all other countries coming trying to come in and take it. And so that becomes a kind of common theme in a lot of Black Panther stories is essentially T'Challa trying to stand against the forces of colonization, people trying to take vibranium for their own purposes. And so it becomes this thing where vibranium becomes not only the sort of lifeblood of the economy, but also the sort of the lifeblood of the country itself. Over time, it's kind of revealed that the properties of vibranium kind of go into the herb that the Black Panther takes to get his powers. And this becomes a thing where he is sort of innately tied to the land and the resources of that country.
And that power is ancestral. And and this seems to be where the Afrofuturism comes from. But when did Black creators first get their hands on this character, Brian, and begin to grow him, deepen him, and make him more relevant?
So this is a great question because, you know, for a long time, that wasn't the case. Now, I want to be a couple of things as I answer that question. Number one, Marvel loves to tell the story about, oh, we were very socially, you know, aware and very advanced. They weren't. They really didn't do much with Black Panther for a long time. It wasn't, you know, Don McGregor, another white writer, came in, and McGregor, compared to a lot of the rest of the Marvel offices, was a really progressive firebrand. He worked very closely with a lot of Black artists, was friends with them. He wanted to tell a story about Wakanda and make it specifically a story in Africa with African characters when he wrote the Jungle Action series in the 70s. And so he fleshes out a lot of what becomes sort of Wakanda and Wakandan culture. Stuff like the, you know, Killmonger, the Warriors Falls from the movie, all that stuff comes from him, the tribes, the sort of like distrust of outsiders. He delves deeply into that and he tells like this 12-issue story. But it's not really until the 90s that we actually see Black writers and artists really kind of take the lead. The first is actually the late, great Dwayne McDuffie. He was a Black Panther fan growing up. He wrote another character called Deathlok. And, Black Panther didn't have an ongoing series at that time. Again, Marvel didn't really do a whole lot with him apart from a couple of things here and there. But he was a character that people really loved. You know, he's sort of like your favorite comics writer's favorite comics character in a lot of cases. McDuffie was a huge fan growing up. You know, he didn't see a lot of other Black superheroes. And so he talks about, like, this is a character who told me that, you know, Black greatness is possible. It's attainable. It's just really something special. It's not a far-fetched reality. It's something that's right there on the page. And so he writes in a story talking about how, like, you know, Deathlok goes to Wakanda, allies with the Black Panther, talks about how important Black Panther is to him, and by extension, Dwayne McDuffie. And then Christopher Priest comes in the late 90s. And it's funny because Priest was this, he'd been a longtime comics editor, longtime comics writer. He'd worked for Marvel and DC. And he comes in and, you know, they're relaunching this imprint called Marvel Knights, trying to make sort of darker, more mature, more adult, complex Marvel stories. And they bring him in. He's like, you guys, please don't give me Black Panther, right? He's like, Black writer, Black Panther, I don't want this character. Because when he grew up with the character, he was just sort of the afterthought. He was the Avengers token Black friend, basically. And so they're like, well, we want to give you Black Panther. And he's really upset about this, but he's like, okay, I'm going to try to make this character cool and relevant. And not only to Black audiences and Black creators like myself, but also to the white audience, right? And so he comes in, and a lot of, honestly, if there are two people who really heavily contribute to what the kind of contemporary popular conception of Black Panther is, it's McGregor and Priest. Priest makes the character cool. He adds a lot of the gadgets. He makes him this kind of mysterious figure. In fact, we don't really get inside his head very much until late in the run. A lot of it is through the sort of white audience surrogate Agent Everett Ross, who is more of a putz in the comics than he is in the movies, you know, and kind of allows him to kind of make all these sort of like offhand jokes about, you know, race relations and politics that are really, really funny. Some haven't aged super well, but some of them are really funny still to this day. You know, and he treats him as this kind of mysterious figure and really makes him, like, he draws a lot of influence from Batman in terms of his gadgets and his cape and that kind of thing. He even gives him like a Joker-like villain. And it's really that run that really kind of makes a lot of people step up and take notice, like, hey, the Black Panther's pretty cool. And then after Priest leaves the book, and it's sort of a long fight between him and Marvel. They make him change a lot of things and try to revamp it constantly because it's not selling crazy well, but it's doing critically very well. Reginald Hudlin, who would then eventually become the president of Black Entertainment Television, another Black Panther fan growing up, takes over the character and says, I'm not going to make this anything other than what I think. He's inspired by Malcolm X. He's inspired by Muhammad Ali, Jay-Z, all these cultural figures. T'Challa, the Black Panther, should be cool. He should be hip. He should be relevant. And he does it. And his book, you know, Christopher Priest said, I was trying really hard to make this character appeal to white audiences. And then Hudlin didn't do that, and his book outsold mine exponentially. And he creates Shuri and brings all these other characters, yes. And also makes it really like there's a you know, he's not ashamed to pull political punches. He has an issue where T'Challa and Blade and Luke Cage go down to New Orleans after Katrina to help out with cleanup, and there's a lot of pointed critiques of the Bush administration in there.
Wow.
And they also fight Confederate vampires. So comics.
Wait, and you mentioned that bringing us Shuri, which brings us to the new movie, which is out midnight tonight, Black Panther Wakanda Forever, the sequel to the 2018 original. And it sets it up perfectly for us with our guest, Brian Carr, Associate Professor of Communication, Information, Science, Women, and Gender Studies at UW Green Bay, author of the book, The Transmedia Construction of the Black Panther, Long Live the King. And if you saw the original and are looking forward to the sequel, or if you read any of the comic books, let us know what you thought at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Our conversation continues on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and we're continuing our talk with UW Green Bay's Brian Carr about the rise of Black Panther, the socio-political superhero ahead of tomorrow's national release of the movie Black Panther Wakanda Forever. Brian's also the author of the book, The Transmedia Construction of the Black Panther, Long Live the King. It goes well beyond our discussion here today, which you can still join before we're done with our guest at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And before we get to the sequel, well, there's one more character in the real world that really had an impact on the Black Panther character in the Marvel Universe, and that is the person who played him in the original 2018 movie, Chadwick Boseman. How did Chadwick change this character, Brian?
So I think you cannot overstate how impactful Chadwick Boseman is. And in the book, I make the case that, you know, we talk a lot about writers and artists and creators, but I think that Boseman and director Ryan Coogler have a tremendous amount of impact, maybe even more than some of the artists and writers, in terms of the cultural consciousness of the character. Here is an actor who fought behind the scenes to do things like, they wanted Black Panther to speak with a British accent. He said, no, that makes no sense. This is a character who comes from an uncolonized nation. He shouldn't speak with a British accent. He fought for the Wakandan language to be a real language. They speak Xhosa, a real African language, in the film. The most impactful line from the original film, where Killmonger is about to die and he says to be buried at sea with his ancestors who jumped rather than suffer bondage, that was apparently also Boseman's doing. So this is a man who is not only, you know, playing a character on screen, he was really, truly creatively crafting this character. And a collaborative sense with the writers and the director of the film. And so it was a tremendous loss when he passed, because this is a guy who really was and embodied all the best elements of this character.
So what do we know about how they're handling the death of Chadwick Boseman in this sequel, Brian?
It is difficult to get anything out of Marvel. So we know for sure that there is a new Black Panther in the film. And this, again, squares with the comics. A Black Panther is a title, not a person. There will be a new Black Panther. We know the Black Panther is likely female. Now, if you are a fan of the comics, you know that his sister Shuri does take over as Black Panther for a while, and then, of course, becomes kind of her own thing when Ta-Nehisi Coates takes over the series for a few years. So the smart money as well, you know, she's going to be the new Black Panther. And I have no idea. I am not privy to any of this. Marvel did not invite me to the premiere. I'm going to guess that she's on the short list of who's going to replace it. And again, this is a story about legacy, in a lot of ways, not just in terms of what the character is in the story, but the legacy of Chadwick Boseman and the larger cultural movement and moment that the original film was. So I think that, you know, it's going to be something where whoever this person is going to symbolically represent that. And as director Coogler says, earn it as well.
Mm. And you mentioned Killmonger, played by Michael B. Jordan in the original 2018 movie, was such a powerful antagonist. Mm-hmm. What do we know about the antagonist that the Black Panther and Wakanda will go up against in this sequel?
You can't see, but I'm smiling really big right now because I'm so excited for this guy. Namor is essentially the king of an underwater nation. It's Atlantis in the comics. It's Talokan in the film. Rather than kind of copy, even though, you know, I always like to tell people Aquaman's the cheap copy of Namor. He came out years after, but Aquaman made a movie first. So they kind of had to reinvent some things about this character. And so they're going with a character who's heavily influenced by Mesoamerican culture, heavily draws from Aztec and Mayan folklore and myth, and again, kind of represents this is a person who has his own kingdom to look out for. He, you know, there is a lot of he has a lot of beef with the surface world because we have, of course, poisoned the oceans. We have done all these things. And I don't know what his specific problem with Wakanda is yet. But he represents this kind of thing where he is sort of in a lot of ways the inverse of T'Challa, or in some ways the same person, but with a bit of a different moral center. He's traditionally in his original incarnation as an anti-hero. He's often been a villain, but he's one of my favorite Marvel characters because he is just this very fascinating, you know, you never quite know where he's going to go. I think they're trying to make him more of a noble anti-hero in this film. And I think that's a good angle. Tanakh Huerta's playing him, and really bringing a lot of, you know, they're bringing a lot of the culture, the language. They worked very closely with actual scholars to pay tribute to and be inspired by that culture, which again, it was very much in line with what they did with African culture in the first film. It's going to be a really interesting way to see how they bring this character in and modernize him.
Brian Carr, do you have your tickets yet?
I do. Yeah, we got them. We're making a whole afternoon of it.
Our guest is the author of The Transmedia Construction of the Black Panther, Long Live the King. Brian Carr is also an associate professor at UW Green Bay. And Namor is something you're looking forward to. What else are you anticipating in this sequel?
I'm really curious thematically. So I will say this, you know, I think Black Panther in general is kind of a cut above the rest of the Marvel output because it is trying to be a bit more about these heavy ideas and these larger things that are beyond just, you know, the sort of like basic surface level notions of heroism. So what I really want to see is the things that Black Panther does historically well, to talk about the ideas of legacy and power and leadership, to talk about the ideas of, you know, colonization and, you know, how do you right the wrongs of the past? This is something that Ta-Nehisi Coates gets into deeply in his Black Panther run, talking about, like, you know, building on his essay, like, you know, the case for reparations and that kind of thing, talking about the legacy of Wakanda. Is Wakanda itself a good thing? And just casting all of this alongside the idea of grief and loss is really powerful. So I'm really curious to see one, obviously the new Black Panther is going to be, but two, how the story goes forward from here. Because there are a lot of different angles and they're introducing a lot of different elements. And we know from what Ryan Coogler has said is that the story is not radically different than the one he had originally turned in, assuming Boseman was going to reprise the role. But it is going to take on a different weight and a different resonance in this context. It's one of those examples where we cannot really separate fiction from the context in which it is written.
Mm. Yeah. So do we know what's next for this franchise, Brian?
We have some ideas. In the comics, we are currently undergoing a story arc where T'Challa is kind of persona non grata in Wakanda. And there is this question about, like, what to do when that vacuum of leadership occurs. Will there be a new Black Panther? Killmonger is being teased to come back. We are also, even though he's dead in the movies, he's still alive in the comics. Nobody ever stays dead in the comics, by the way. Like, it's just like dying is like a temporary illness. Like, you get better real quick. But, you know, in the films, we know that there is going to be a Disney Plus series set in Wakanda called, I believe it's called World of Wakanda, but they might have changed that. We don't know exactly what it's going to be about, but presumably we're going to be seeing some stories either from Wakandan history, which could be really, really exciting, or we're going to be delving more into the culture and kind of like the, you know, what it's like to be not necessarily the king or the people at the top, but also just like what Wakandan culture and what stories from that place are like. That's going to be a series coming up. I believe Ryan Coogler's going to be very closely involved with that. And of course, these characters are always going to crop up and show up in other media. You know, there's a very good case to be made that, you know, what happens in this film is going to have traumatic implications for the next several years of these films. I've already teased that. So, you know, even though the secrets are what they are, I think that we are certainly going to see a lot more of Black Panther and Wakanda in the future. Possibly even, you know, maybe we will see a different actor take on the mantle once they've had some time to kind of properly process the loss.
It is an entire universe that is open to us, but it also is a part of our universe as well. And the ties between them are fascinating, Brian, and I thank you so much for sharing them with us today.
Thank you.
Brian Carr is an associate professor of communication, information science, and women and gender studies at UW Green Bay. Talk to him today about his book, The Transmedia Construction of the Black Panther, Long Live the King, which goes well beyond our conversation here today. We didn't even get to the video games, the TV, and Kendrick Lamar's album, but it's all available for you through his book, The Transmedia Construction of the Black Panther, Long Live the King. Tomorrow is the national release of the Black Panther sequel, Wakanda Forever.